accepted with such enthusiasm the terms of emancipation. It's true that they were more enlightened than the Enlightenment people, but that is no answer. I can just answer with a question. Why is the young working class chap in England so keen to crash the Oxford Common Rule? In other words, that's something I really cannot explain to you. That you find it difficult to understand is very interesting, I think, and quite significant. But on the whole, there's nothing here I can explain to you. You just have to accept it as a fact that Jews wanted to assimilate, and that emancipation and the conditions of emancipation were worth it, and that many of them who were enlightened even agreed with these conditions. I think it may be a little easier for you when I come to the ghetto and the meaning of the ghetto for the West. I think that is something you don't have, that is something you you forget. But when I come to the meaning of the ghetto for the West, you will see that that was a constant impetus to accept the condition of emancipation, which some of you find so difficult to accept. Now, last time I talked about the mission of Judaism, which came out of the acceptance of the conditions of emancipation, and which, like all of the things I have talked about, was an adjustment to the conditions of emancipation. As some of you had some difficulty, let me just sum up this mission of Judaism, and let me sum it up through the words of Abraham Geiger, which he wrote down in 1864, and which would hold for Neo-Orthodoxy and for his more strongly reform movement. As Geiger put it, the essence of Judaism is reason. God indeed works through a beam of divine reason. This beam of divine reason ennobles man, awakes in him the longing to rise to ever greater heights of reason. But what is crucial is the moral force awakened in man through that beam of divine reason. For what Judaism wants is to bring the essence of this morality to all mankind. And the essence of this morality is justice and mercy. Justice and mercy is the idea of Judaism. All else is accretion. In other words, these people were Hegelians. Now, I'm not going to give a lecture on Hegel, but these people were Hegelians, and they believed that the Hegelian idea was really the idea of Judaism, justice and mercy in this case. All else is accretion. To this ethical monotheism, as I called it last time, the so-called science of Judaism was added. It becomes the concrete expression which will affect everyone in the community quite directly all over the West and in Eastern Europe too. For the science of Judaism is in a sense a product of Romanticism rather than radicalism. What it takes up for Jews is what the Romantics took up in general, that is, a new sense of history. And that new sense of history went side by side with the idea of reason that I have just described, with the idea of the divine beam of reason. To that, history was now added. Indeed, history took some of the place of orthodoxy. It is a general thing in all religions, whether Christianity or Judaism, whether Orthodox Christianity or Orthodox Judaism, that a historical standpoint dissolves the orthodoxy. Some of you know this from Christianity. The historic of Christ becomes the historical figure. That dissolves much of Christian orthodoxy, as you know. So when history was introduced into, if you like, Judaism, as it now was, it further dissolved orthodoxy. It substituted not only reason, but also history for the former traditional orthodox foundation. And that at a time when the science of history was being pounded in Germany again, not only by Hegel himself, but by the first historian of Rome, Niebuhr, and others. Indeed, the young Jews who met in 1819, were under the direct influence of Hegel, once again. Again, the penetration of Hegelianism into Judaism is what is involved in the science of Judaism. These young Jews in 1919 founded a club, if you like, for the culture and scholarship among Jews. The German is Verein für Kultur und Wissenschaft der Juden. A club for culture and scholarship among Jews. The title took over a German concept and applied it to the Jewish heritage. Here, the so-called science of Judaism was born. That is, die Wissenschaft des Judentums, the science of Judaism, a German achievement with far-reaching consequences. The term science of Judaism was first used here. Typically enough, the leading spirit among these young Jews was Leopold Zuntz. And Leopold Zuntz was the first young Jew in Germany to go to a university. He was the first Jew ever admitted in the new University of Berlin. It is there that he got his historical and philological training. The second moving spirit was Eduard Ganz. Eduard Ganz was a disciple of Hegel, a very close personal disciple of Hegel. Zuntz and Ganz, both of them were members. A more famous member was the poet Heinrich Heine, who also joined the circle. Heine, Ganz, Zuntz, these were the leading spirit. The club itself did not last very long, but the paper it published through the mid-1920s set the tone. And that club became the origin of a movement which influenced Jewish institutions. That is where it became very influential. First, it influenced the first newly founded rabbinical seminary in Germany, the Zork Seminary in the town of Breslau, known as the Breslau Rabbinical Seminary. From then, it went on to determine the more famous Berlin Jewish Seminary, the famous, really, it's really institution for teaching, the Lehranstalt in Berlin, founded in 1872. And through Berlin, it influenced the founding of Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati in 1875. From that small group of young Jews of 1919, these are the radiating out institutional connections. From the Breslau Seminary of 1854 to the Berlin Seminary of 1873 to Hebrew Union College. But that was not all. The rabbinical seminaries in Rome, in Budapest, in London, they all felt this impulse. So that indeed the science of Judaism became central to the training of rabbis and teachers for the community. What was this science of Judaism? What was this attitude? With that question, I want to go directly to the manifesto drawn up in 1822. And we look at that manifesto, I think things will become a little clearer. First of all, the basic idea was Geiger, to set free the idea of Judaism after centuries of darkness. The idea of Judaism must again become a part of the progress of the human spirit, a part of what we would call the Hegelian idea. Therefore, you had to go back to history, and you had to see what went wrong. This is what went wrong, and I read from the manifesto. Excluded from public life, restricted to certain fields of activity, the Jews were more and more pushed back into their own unique world, handed down to them by their fathers and forefathers. But the life of this world that had been preserved from antiquity became more and more constricted and hollow, for the living spirit could no longer move freely within it. Since then, and until the present day, that's 1822, the rabbis confined themselves to their scholastic preoccupations. But that is the nature of scholasticism, to follow the letter of a tradition assumed to be holy and inviolable, to develop from within it every aspect of human knowledge in all directions, and thus to hamper every free individual and living movement of the human mind, and to preclude any rational and independent understanding of infinite truths. Thus the Jews in general now live, and most of all their scholars, in hollow isolation. The science of Judaism, therefore, was an attempt to go back to history. From antiquity, the history of Judaism was a history gone wrong. That must be clear from the excerpt that I just wrote to you. It was history gone wrong. What then must be done? The new sciences must be used together with history. The parallel to the new science and rationalism. For history to them was also a science, and thus preoccupation with natural or historical science will change Judaism again. But the free spirit of science breaks through the weeds of a ceremonial that a thousand years of habit have made mechanical and lifeless, and within it sees the self-same idea of God that was formerly revealed in all its clarity. Where external pressure has ceased, the spirit can begin to develop more freely. And here now you come to the Hegelianism again. The idea strives to free itself from the unyielding walls in which it has been imprisoned, and must once again reveal itself in its own inner spiritual essence. That own inner spiritual essence can only be recaptured through the science of history. For you have to go back to antiquity to get a Judaism without rabbis, a Judaism without scholasticism. And you have to study history scientifically to realize the wholeness and Jewish history gone wrong into a mechanical way which has obliterated the Hegelian idea. What sort of a study of history? And here again, to this study of history, science was applied. Science, the new scholarly science of the 19th century. The science of Judaism, what does it? It treats the object of study in and for itself, for its own sake, and not for any special purpose and intention. It begins without any preconceived opinion and is not concerned with the final result. It is, in other words, a science and self-sufficient. This must be true of the science of Judaism as it is true of the natural and historical sciences everywhere, indeed. The aims, therefore, of the club are the following. First, study. Judaism in its historical and literary writings, just as I have said with these ideas. Secondly, statistical study of Judaism in relation to present-day Jews scattered throughout the world. The aim will be to depict Judaism first from a historical standpoint, as it has gradually developed and changed, and then philosophically, according to its inner essence and idea. Here again, you have to have an impartial historical investigation before you can recapture the essence and the idea, which is the monotheistic ethical idea I talked about. The textual knowledge of the literature of Judaism must precede both methods of study. Thus we have first the textual study of Judaism, secondly a history of Judaism, thirdly a philosophy of Judaism. The climax is, however, the philosophy which depends on history and which gives us the idea of God without the idea of the accretions of centuries. The ethical monotheism, the mission of Judaism, is now part, an integral part, of the science of Judaism. This then was its attitude, and its attitude is problematical, as Gerson Scholem, himself a product of this, and everybody realizes. Why is it problematical? Because it trained generations of rabbis in this ethical monotheism, and it does not bend. It is not subject to Zionism. It is not subject to Orthodoxy. That is why the problem of a whole generation in Israel today, an older generation, including the president of the State of Israel, Salman Rubachov, all of them come from the science of Judaism. All of them went through the Berlin Seminary, by and large. And the conflicts which come from this approach, and of course Zionism, which are mutually incompatible. That is why this approach is problematical for later Zionism, and of course for Orthodoxy. For the history of Judaism ends up in an ethical monotheism. It is not free of all values. It is in fact Hegelian. It is in fact the application of Hegel to Jewish studies. It is important to realize that over these young men who gathered in 1919, over half converted to Christianity, including Eduard Ganz. Leopold Zuntz seriously played with this idea. The young man who drew up this manifesto, from which I read you, Immanuel Wolf, left behind Judaism also to come to a purely rational religion. He took the last step. Only conscience and reason counts. Only that counts. He took the last step. The man who drew up, young man who drew up this manifesto. Heinrich Heine, of course, converted to Christianity as well. This shows you, perhaps, some of the problematic in the science of Judaism. From the point of view of emancipation and assimilation, the science of Judaism culminates a development. That development I have now tried to at least analyze for you very briefly. It goes, therefore, in several steps, parallel with the edicts of toleration, with the state idea of emancipation. First of all, you have, as you well know, the idea to keep the balance with Moses Mendelssohn. Then you have, evermore, the rationalism coming out in ethical monotheism, in the religious reforms, which also, remember, adjusted the service from a Jew school to a kind of parallelism to Protestantism. Finally, you have the science of Judaism,
the historical dimension in it. All of these interact with what was happening in the general world, the Enlightenment, Romanticism, and the ascendancy of Hegelian philosophy. All of these are here reflected in the adjustment which Jews as a community made to emancipation. For in the end, in the West, the community servants will be trained and come from seminaries which accept fully the science of Judaism. That one must not forget. So that in the end, this adjustment through the science of Judaism affected everyone, affected indeed the whole community. I have stressed Germany up to now, for Germany was the center of this development. There, it was pioneered. There was the center, because it was the center of Romanticism as well. And therefore, the German Jewish elite became, in a sense, the leading Jewish elite, and will, in a sense, remain so throughout the 19th century, even in the early history of Zionism. You may well ask, why not France? Why not France? And there is a reason of why the Jews in France, equally wealthy, equally prominent, equally accepting emancipation, did not play such a leading intellectual role. In France, the July Revolution of 1830 had brought full emancipation. And indeed, from 1830 on, something that was not true in Germany, the Jewish religion was an official cult, officially supported by the government. That is, rabbis were financed by the government as every other clergy. From 1831, after the July Revolution, Judaism became an official cult. That will not happen in Central Europe, but it happened in France very early. But here also, the rich bourgeoisie went the same way. If we take one of the leaders, Isaac Adolphe Crémieux, a very famous name in France, he did the same thing that these wealthy, cultivated people did in Germany. He went into politics, and in 1842 was the first Jew to enter the Chamber of Deputies. And yet, in France, the reform movement never made much stride, made some stride, but never that much stride. And the science of Judaism was a German, not a French affair, though it was also accepted in the French theological seminaries. Why? The main reason is something that we mentioned before. We mentioned in discussion Friday, the body of Orthodox Jews in Alsace and Lorraine, something that Germany just did not have. The body of Jews in Alsace and Lorraine, Orthodox, ghettoized, if you like. So that from the beginning, the French Consistoire, the central governing body of French Judaism, had to have a balance. A balance between reform, which people like Crémieux personally adopted, and orthodoxy of the masses of French Jewry, which came into Paris and elsewhere from Alsace and Lorraine. Therefore, French Jewish intellectual life was really paralyzed. This you didn't have in Germany. There was no such orthodox body of Jewry. All German Jewry was wealthy, upper class, haute bourgeoisie, and cultured. In France, this was, on the whole, not the case. The cultured elite were surrounded by masses
of Orthodox Jewry, at least at the beginning of the century. So that French Jewry made very little contribution, and that in fact will remain so. Now, there is one other European country that has the same problem, Austria. For Austria also had masses of Orthodox ghettoized Jewry in Galicia. And the Galician Jews, that is that part of Poland that came to Austria in the 18th century, Galicia. And in Austria you have something quite similar, as a matter of fact. The Austrian Jews also were, you might almost say, paralyzed. They were doubly paralyzed. With them, even the liberalism of Kramer and the Germans hardly existed. The Austrian Jews from the beginning were closely tied to the Habsburg dynasty, especially the Jewish elite. Why? Two reasons. One, Francis Joseph, who came to power in 1848, when all Jewish discriminatory legislation was dropped. Francis Joseph was philo-Semitic. That is to say, throughout his long reign until 1916, he always enforced or tried to enforce pro-Jewish attitude, and not only that, he always tried to enforce the anti-discriminatory measures, so that the Habsburg dynasty was indeed, from that point of view, a pro-Jewish. That's one reason why the Jewish elite in Austria never went in a liberal direction. And the second is that they lived in a multinational empire. It wasn't only being Jews, it was also being Germans. They were both Jews and Germans. And therefore, they became patriotic in the sense of supporting the German Austrians against the other nationalities. So that in Austria you have a picture of Jews assimilating more thoroughly than anywhere else, not believing, we shall come back to that, not believing even in the presence of anti-Semitism, really, never doing anything about it until very late, because they felt a security in the dynasty, and they felt as Germans, because the Germans were pressed in the multinational empire, and not only the Jews. So they felt as Germans as well. It is clear from what I have said that emancipation and reaction were not the same all over Europe. The great exception is Italy. And about Italy, I must now say a special word. For Italy was to be an exception. You can say that in all the others I have discussed, there are similarities. But Italy is an exception because Italy is an exception in Europe. For in Italy, there is the papacy. And in Italy, there are the papal states. And in Italy, there was the kingdom of Sicily and Naples, the symbol of reaction. It made it different. The papacy sought after the French Revolution to abrogate everything that had to do with the French Revolution. And that meant that in Italy, in the papal states, and Sicily and Naples, after 1815, there was a reverse development that only happened in Eastern Europe. Eastern Europe and the papal states, I missed the thing. There is a reverse development where Jews were emancipated in the West, discriminations were clamped down in the papal states, and as you will see, in Eastern Europe, in the same way. For being against the French Revolution, the papacy undid Jewish emancipation straight away. Jews were forced again to live in the ghetto. They were again sorted out, forbidden to have Christian servants. They had to have permission to travel and for marriage. Pope Leo XII from 1823 to 29, but Pope Leo XII introduced again the ancient restrictions. But this was true not only in the Papal States, but also in Sicily and Naples, also in certain states in northern Italy. Florence was a certain exception. Now, what was the result? The result was that young Jews immediately entered radical politics. Not liberal politics, but radical politics. For they saw what was happening elsewhere in the West and what was happening to them. It isn't like living in Poland and being ghettoized there by the anti-Jewish laws of 1805. That was away from the West. But in Italy, you knew immediately what was happening in France and Germany. And so Jews joined radical parties rather than liberalism. Therefore, you get a curious phenomenon. Jews were overrepresented in the secret society for Italian unity, violent and secret, known as the Carbonari. They were overrepresented also in Mazzini's organization called Young Italy. Now why? Because it was clear that Italian unification would mean Jewish emancipation, that you couldn't have Jewish emancipation as long as the Papal States existed, as long as Naples and Sicily existed. And therefore young Jews joined these violent organizations, the Carbonari, and indeed became leaders in the Carbonari, the ancestors of a new organization that I'm glad to say now exists in the state of Israel, which calls itself the Jewish Black Panthers. It's the ancestor of that that Israeli organization. Violence, all of that. So they're not modeled about the Carbonari. Jewish history is hardly taught in Israel. They're modeled on the Black Panthers. They know more about that. But anyway, there is a Jewish precedent in the Carbonari for all of this. They were overrepresented then in this violent secret organization. They were overrepresented also in Young Italy. Nowhere was the fate of Jewry so bound up with the faith of national unity as in Italy. And indeed, the only state that did not introduce Jewish restriction was Piedmont and Savoy. And so, with the leader of Piedmont and Savoy, with Cavour, Jewish faith was intimately linked. And Jews became preeminent in that struggle for national unification, as they did nowhere else. That national unification was accomplished, as you know, by 1860, except for Rome. And in Rome, the Jews lived in the ghetto until 1870, until the papal regime fell. Until 1870, the ghetto of Rome was maintained. This different picture in Italy, then, was due in large measure to the church, which became the bastion of reaction both before 1848 and after 1848, and certain Italian states which followed the lead of the church. Jews and national unity were linked here. Jews, therefore, were bound up with the Risorgimento, that is to say, with the movement of Italian unity, as they were not bound up with the movement of a German unity or anything like that. Moreover, the movement for Italian unity was a humanitarian nationalism, that is to say, Mazzini's nationalism, defining itself against reaction, against Catholicism, against the Pope, was a nationalism which was liberal and humanitarian and not aggressive. They were linked with that. What is the result? From the beginning, Jews were integrated in Italy as they were in no other nation. In no other nation. Not only in liberal politics, but, for example, in the army, which was true nowhere else. Typically enough, in 1902, General Giuseppe Ottolengo was the first Jew ever to become a minister of war. There was only one other Jew who became a minister of war in modern history in the late 1930s, Horb Elisha in England in the Chamberlain cabinet. But he was a civilian. Jews in Italy became generals and several ministers of war. We can go further. For example, the military commander of Rome in 1922, General Emanuele Pugliese, who made Mussolini's seizure of power possible, he was the military commander of Rome, was a Jew. Mussolini's chief of general staff was a Jew. In other words, I'm telling you this to make clear to you that kind of integration. Now, France had a Captain Dreyfus, but that was a rarity. The whole Dreyfus case arose because it was a rarity to have a Jew as a captain in the army. In Italy, it was not because of this background. Moreover, the largest category of employed Jews in Italy was in the public service. Now, that is very telling for integration, because in Germany, they couldn't enter public service. You remember what I said. Much of public service was barred. In France, they entered it occasionally. In Italy, the greatest category of employed Jews is in state service, in public service. Now, one other factor I must throw in. In Italy, there was less emigration from Eastern Europe than in the other countries. That will be important. And the 40,000 Italian Jews, something between 30,000 and 40,000 in our period now, 30,000 or 40,000 Italian Jews then achieved the kind of integration that was not achieved anywhere else in Western Europe for these historical reasons. In Italy also, otherwise, the science of Judaism penetrated. But reform movement never penetrated to that extent, never penetrated at all, in a way. Why? Difficult to say. I have no answer, really. But in a Catholic country, again, there was, after all, no Protestantism to adjust to. That is also an answer of why it never made it in France very much. In a Catholic country, there is no Protestantism to adjust to, and in a Catholic country, ceremonial is taken for granted in religion, as it is not in Protestant countries. So the penetration of reform, certainly in France and Italy, has something to do with the fact that these were Catholic and not Protestant countries. It did the science of Judaism, to some extent, a reform by and large, a dip. The Jewish reaction to emancipation, therefore, had national variations. But what never varies, what remains constant, is the underlying problem. How close to Christianity? How close to the state? Reform sought to answer the first, how close to Christianity? And how close to the state was universally answered in the affirmative. And yet, there is one part of this missing to which I must now come. The part that we can call going all the way. The part of Christian conversion. For after all, to conversion to Christianity, the kind of barrier which cuts describes are no longer operative. What about conversion? What about conversion? Conversion can exist on several levels. And I must start with the general thing. Now, I know that I'm running in here again to a problem. If the first problem I ran into is that you couldn't understand why Jews should accept emancipation, it really seems to be obvious, but to you apparently not. Why Jews should accept emancipation? If that was difficult for you to understand, it's still more difficult to understand why Jews should accept conversion to Christianity, partly because Christianity doesn't matter very much today anymore. But we're now in a period when it matters very much indeed. And that is something that you must always bear in mind. You must always bear in mind. There are three ways of conversion. One, the one that you probably think is always operative, but it is not. The purely utilitarian one. It did open all doors. This is always a factor. But with emancipation, it is especially tempting. It was a total escape. There is no racist ideas yet. It doesn't exist. So conversion is a total acceptance. A total acceptance for better employment, for advancement, for status. Jews could become state officials, professors, anything they like. Guns converted in order to get an academic chair. Come back to Guns' conversion a little later to get an academic chair. You could be anything. And the answer is not, I think, historically, why convert, but why the hell not? In other words, why not go the whole way? Why not be accepted as an equal? Why not have every profession open to you? That is the kind of idea that you must get into your head. Because that is the way it was envisaged. It was astonishing if it didn't happen. It isn't very astonishing if it did happen. Second, very important, I'll talk about it. Conversion as an instantaneous vision of faith. Conversion as a deep commitment. Well, in our day, you may have heard of Simon Weil. In the day that I will talk about Kerfer, Ratisbon. You all know, some of you have been to Israel, know the Ratisbon Monastery. Now it's cheap student housing. You don't know what's behind it. Ratisbon in France, instantaneous conversion, thanks to a religious vision. And thirdly, perhaps for us, in the end, the most important conversion. Conversion to Christianity under the impetus of Romanticism and the Enlightenment, which is really basically conversion to philosophy rather than to Christianity. Basic, really conversion to Hegelianism, to philosophy. But also, let us put it this way perhaps, conversion to culture. That's perhaps the best way to put it. Because the conversions we shall study, and they are very important, are conversions to be part of the ongoing culture, and not to be apart from the ongoing culture, which was Romanticism. But Romanticism included Christianity, included an undogmatic Christianity. Thus we have, if you like, a threefold typology of conversion. The utilitarian one, the one that we might call conversion and commitment, which however starts usually with a religious vision. As you will see, Sir Burr had a vision of that nature before he became a Ratisbon, with a religious vision. And certainly, the conversion, which is really a part of emancipation, and assimilation, a conversion to culture, to be abreast of culture. These three are the three kinds of conversion. And why not? As Schleiermacher said, who moved in emancipated Jewish circle, who married Moses Mendelssohn's daughter, as Schleiermacher said about Judaism, those who yet wear its livery are only sitting lamenting, besides the imperishable mummy, bewailing its departure and its dead legacy. That will be the conversion to philosophy. And with that, I will go on Wednesday.